I want to share with you now what I consider to be one of the most important pieces of information I ever received in a spiritual context. It's so important, in fact, this message that I'm going to share with you. It's so important that every one of the world's great religions agrees on this particular point. There's a lot of conflict or contrast, at the very least, between the world's great religions. We know that in the fine print, in, you know, when it gets down to the fine points, almost all the world's great religions disagree with each other. But here is a point on which not a single religion disagrees. That is, every major religion on the face of the earth teaches what I'm going to share with you now. It's also a fundamental teaching of conversations with God. So let's take a close look at this. Let's really explore this one deeply. Because this is not unimportant. This is not trivial. Your understanding of what I'm going to share with you now and the way you hold it in your experience could impact and shape the experience of the rest of your life. Okay? Here's the message. Death does not exist. Now, every great religion says the same thing. Death does not exist. Every great religion talks about an afterlife, that is, life after death. Every great religion talks about the aspect of the individual that some religions refer to as the spirit or the soul. And most of the world's great religions teach us that when the body does the thing called die, that we call death, when the body dies, the soul continues to exist. And not for a little while, not for a short period of time. But in fact, most of the world's religions teach that the soul exists forever, eternally, without end. So the question in the teachings of most of the world's religions is not whether life continues forever, but how? In what way? What is the, how would I put this, the quality of that life? Is it a good life that goes on forever? Or is it not such a good life? Or to put it in theological terms, are we in paradise or in heaven, living in bliss? Or are we in that other place, Hades or hell, living in misery and suffering and eternal terror? Or are we maybe, as some religions would have it, in a third place, at least for a while, that some religions call purgatory, kind of a limbo place between heaven and hell, kind of a suburb of these two other locations in the afterlife? I'm not trying to make fun of it, I'm just explaining to you in the best way I can that these are the teachings of some of the world's great religions. And I've wondered about this whole idea of death most of my life. As have many people. I haven't met many people. There are some, but I haven't met many who are not fascinated, at least at some level, who are not intrigued, at least at some level, about this experience called death. We ask questions like, why does death even have to happen? Why can't we just live forever? Or what occurs after death, and what's true about all of that? And I'm one of those people. I've been wondering about that for a very long time, as I said, for most of my adult life. So finally, when I was having my conversations with God, I simply asked God, you know, these questions. And God gave me a collection of answers, a long list of answers, so long that it created an entire book. And it's a book that I really want to commend to your reading. I want to suggest and recommend that you read it. If you have an interest in this topic of death and what happens after death, if you have the same kind of interest that I have had in my life. The book is called Home with God in a Life That Never Ends. Yes? The title again? Home with God in a Life That Never Ends. And it helps to expand and explore and explain the new theology of conversations with God and the differences between what conversations with God is sharing with us and what is shared with us by most of the world's great religions. I began my inquiry, I began my own personal investigation into this topic by asking God simply, what is death? What is death anyway? And God said something to me that I never heard from any other source before in my life. It was a really interesting response. And here's what God said. God said, Neil, death is merely a process of re-identification. Have you ever heard that before? I found it fascinating to hear such a response. Death is a process of re-identification. It's a process through which we change our identity from what we thought we were or understood ourselves to be, that's true for most people, to what we actually are, to our real identities. You see, most people are living a case of mistaken identity. Now, spiritual masters don't experience that. They don't experience death as a process of re-identification. They experience death as a confirmation of what they always understood and always knew themselves to be. But people who are living at that level of mastery while they're in the physical body are rare so far on the planet. Perhaps in highly evolved cultures, maybe elsewhere in the universe, that's not true. But here on Earth, there are very few people, one in a billion, every so often one comes along, who is a spiritual master and is moving through life at such a level of understanding that they're very clear that they are not their body, they're not their mind, that they are an eternal soul that lives forever and ever. So for them, death is not a process of re-identification so much as a process of confirmation. Confirming for them what they always knew to be true. But for most of us, for me, I'm sure it'll be a process of re-identification. I mean, I have an intellectual understanding. I have an awareness in my mind that I am a spirit, but I'm not sure yet that I've moved into the full expression of that while I'm in physical form. This idea that life goes on forever, by the way, is not limited to religions alone. Most of our common cultures, long before religions were even established, held a belief that the personality somehow or in some way remained intact after life and went on in some mysterious way for reasons unknown but unquestioned. So we find when we do archaeological studies of periods of time in human history, long before organized religions came along, we find tombs and altars and evidence of the thought in those cultures that the person who passed out of physical life lives on and goes forward and goes on forever. People actually brought gifts, flowers and other gifts, offerings, if you will, to those who had passed on and lay them either at the grave or at the tomb or at the monument that memorialized their life and their passing. Again, this is long before organized religion. So we see then that somehow this idea that life does not end when physicality ends has been around for a very long time. I wonder how that's true. I wonder how that's possible. Why would that be so ingrained in the human experience, even it's a kind of like a cellular understanding at the level of human cells, long before religions told us about this. I suspect that the reason that we have understood that at such a deep level, even before we were taught it by religions, is because the cells of humanity understand everything. That is, we know at a cellular level everything we need to know about anything at all. And I think, therefore, it's instinctive for us to be aware that life does not end when physicality ends. But the real question is if that's true, because there are some people who still wonder. Maybe it's not true. Maybe it's just wishful thinking. Do you think? Maybe it's just like we hope that life goes on. And maybe that's why it's been part of our culture, even before religion. Maybe we just don't want the end of life to occur. We don't want people to pass away and we don't want to think of them as never, no longer existing. So maybe it's just wishful thinking, do you think? Well, I've been told in conversations with God that it's not wishful thinking. That in fact, life does go on forever and even forevermore. That on this particular point, even the world's organized religions have it absolutely correct. What happens after death may not be accurate according to the teachings of some of the world's religions, but the fact that life goes on forever is, in fact, an accurate teaching. So if true, why does life go on? That would be the question. Or maybe the larger question is, why are we here? If the life of the soul and the life of the spirit is eternal, then why have we taken the time, if I could put it that way, to become physical and to spend a certain period in physicality rather than living our lives in spirituality always and forever? And another question that comes up is, do we have only one lifetime in physicality, or do we come back into physicality more than once? There are many, many belief systems that say yes, of course. And we all understand the word for that is reincarnation. And there are a lot of people, billions of people, who believe in the concept of reincarnation. That is, the idea that we come back to physical life more than once. Conversations with God teaches us, in fact, that that's also true. That we come back into physical life not only more than once, but in fact a countless number of times. Many, 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 many times. Perhaps thousands of times. Perhaps millions of times. Actually, endlessly. And so we learn from conversations with God that life is in fact eternal and is a process that moves from the physical to the non-physical, or what we call the spiritual, to the physical, to the metaphysical, to the physical, to the metaphysical, and just keeps on moving back and forth that way, eternally, forever and ever, and even forevermore. And we confront the question then, if that's true, why? What's the point? What is the purpose of that? Conversations with God explains the purpose of it very clearly across the 9 books of the Dialogue series. I'll give it to you, my answer to that question here very briefly. The reason for the movement back and forth between the physical and the metaphysical and the spiritual and the non-spiritual or the physical is to give us an opportunity to move from the realm of the absolute to the realm of the relative in order that we might express and experience what we have understood ourselves to know. In the realm of the absolute, we understand and know fully who we are, what's so, what's true, and what is. But we can't experience it because that's all there is. So you can't know what vanilla ice cream tastes like if you've never tasted anything else. I mean, imagine that that's all you ever had in your entire life was vanilla ice cream. I mean, nothing else. Not chocolate ice cream, not strawberry ice cream, not any other kind of food at all. No potatoes, no meat, no vegetables, no nothing. If all you ever ate in your entire life was vanilla ice cream, and somebody said, what does that taste like? You wouldn't be able to describe it because it's all there is. So, and that's how it is, by the way, in the realm of the absolute. Things are what they absolutely are. It's lovely to know it. It's lovely to know that I'm love. I'm nothing else but love, and God is nothing else but love, and it's always here, it's always now. But if I don't have anything to compare it to, I don't have any experience of it. I merely have a knowing. But knowing and experiencing are not the same thing. Let me give you an example to make it really simple for you to understand. When we're young, in our early teens, perhaps 13, 14, 15, we begin to understand that there's something going on the earth called sexuality. Somewhere between the age of 10 and the age of 13 or 14, we begin to get a notion. Oh, there's this thing called sexuality. We discover it in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different lives, but most young people at some point in their life learn about sexuality before they experience it. So they know about it, but they haven't experienced it. I'm using this example because it's so dramatic and everybody can relate to it. Remember the time when you knew about spirituality, but didn't experience it? Remember the time when you knew about sexuality, but didn't experience it? What did you most want? Well, of course, you wanted to experience it. You couldn't wait to experience it. And the first time you experienced it, you wanted to experience more of it, and more of it, and more of it. And that's the way it is with spirituality as well. So in the realm of the absolute, we know all about it. We've read all the books, we've seen all the pictures, but now we want to experience it. But you can't experience it when there's nothing else but the absolute. So we move into the realm of the relative, or what we call the physical, where everything exists relative to other things, where there is, in fact, male and female, where there is, in fact, up and down, left and right, here and there, before and after, big and small, fast and slow, dark and light, good and evil, and hot and cold, and all of the other contrasting elements of life that allow us to know in our experience what we have understood in our awareness, to turn concept into experience. We move from the realm of the absolute to the realm of the relative, or if you please, from the metaphysical to the physical, back to the metaphysical, back to the physical. And that's the purpose of the everlasting process. But why even bother with that? Because all of this is what I'm going to call God, knowing itself experientially. That God's greatest desire is to know itself experientially, not just conceptually, but experientially. And so, to move into some theological statements, God created life. God created life not just on this planet, by the way, but throughout the cosmos, throughout the universe. And we now know that we live in a universe of universes. We thought we lived in a universe, but it turns out we live in a multiverse. That is, we live in a universe of universes. And that's what we are now understanding from cosmologists and from astronomers. And so we see then that the purpose of life is to allow that which created life, that which is expressing life, to express life experientially through the individuation of itself. And by that process, life informs life about life through the eventualities of life itself. It's an extraordinary plan, if you please, an extraordinary adventure. But that's the answer to the question. Why does life go on eternally? Now, is life a school? I'm told the answer is no. We don't keep coming back into physical form and back to the spirit and back to the physical and back to the spirit in order to learn something. Life is not a school. Conversations with God tells us that life is a process by which we remember and have an opportunity to re-express and to expand on who we really are. So life is a process of remembering and evolving and expanding so we can experience more and more and more and more of the totality of who we really are. Now here's an important question. Is there any relationship between what happens in our physical life and what happens in our spiritual life? That is there any relationship between what is occurring now and what will occur in the hereafter? Well, that's a question that every religion, every organized religion on the face of the earth has sought to answer. And most of the organized religions say yes. Yes, there is a relationship. What you do here in the realm of the physical is going to impact and affect what you experience here when you return to the realm of the spiritual. And that is where we encounter the entire idea of heaven and hell, reward and punishment. So we confront a major question that revolves around the whole topic of death. And that question has made death not just a mystery, but a fearful thing for many, many people, because many, many people on the earth are fearful that they may not have lived in the right way, they may have not have done everything they needed to do, or they may have done some things that they weren't supposed to do, but for one reason or another, when they die, they could not be going back to God in heaven, but could in fact be condemned to everlasting damnation. Not for a short period of time, as I mentioned before, not for a little bit here and there, but for the rest of eternity, everlasting damnation. several religions on the earth teaches that concept, presumably in order to frighten us or to scare us into behaving in the way that those religions' teachers feel that we are supposed to be behaving in order to please a dominating and demanding God who requires us to behave in a certain way in order to allow us to come back into heaven. I'm going to leave it to you to decide whether that's true for you. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that shouldn't be true for you. If you believe that's true, embrace that belief and live your life accordingly. Conversations with God made it very clear to me that that is not true. When I was asked on one of the national television programs in the United States a few years ago, what is God's message to the world? A particular TV host said to me, Neil, you claim to have had an actual conversation with God. If you really did have a conversation with God, what's God's message to the world? And you know, they always ask you those questions when you have about 30 seconds left in the program. They never give you an hour and a half to give an answer to a question that big. They say, you know, Neil, we have about 30 seconds. Could you give it to us in one paragraph? And I thought about it for just a moment, just a flicker of a time. And I thought, what can I say to this man in 30 seconds in answer to the question? What is God's message to the world? And the answer came to me just that fast. I said, you know what? I can do it in less than one paragraph. I can give it to you in 5 words. At least 5 words in English. And so he said, okay, here is God's message to the world in 5 words. Neil? And I was able to deliver those 5 words. Here is God's message to the world in 5 words. You've got me all wrong. You've got me all wrong. I don't need anything from you. I don't demand anything from you. I don't require anything from you. There is no judgment. There is no condemnation. There is no punishment. There is no everlasting damnation. Guys, you've got me all wrong. Could that be true? Could it really be true that there is a God, that life is eternal, that life goes on forever and ever, but there's no condemnation, there's no judgment, there's no punishment? It just goes on without any of that? And the new theology in conversations with God says yes. That is the good news. I mean, the really good news. Conversations with God agrees with the religions of the world that death does not exist, but disagrees with the world's religions, which tell us that there is judgment, condemnation, and everlasting punishment. What Conversations with God tells us that death is simply a process of re-identification in which you reclaim and re-experience who you really are, in which you know again your true identity, in which you come to be aware and conscious, fully aware and totally conscious of everything, who and what God is, why you are in physicality, what the purpose of everlasting life, both in the physical and the metaphysical, is about, and how to move through that everlasting experience in such a way that you accomplish and achieve the agenda of the soul. If God were to punish us, God would be punishing itself, because there's nothing else but God. That's the second part of this new theology from Conversations with God. Of course, as you know, the cosmology holds. It tells us that there is only one thing. All things are part of the one thing there is. There is only one thing. There is only that which we call God. Or if you please, if you'd like to use different words, the essential essence, the pure energy, that which is. Or to get really very simple in our choice of words, life. Life itself. is that which God is. And all of us are part of life. All of us are part of that which God is. Each of us is like a wave is to the ocean. We are an expression of the ocean, but in no way separate from it, in no way other than the ocean. We are simply an individuated expression of the ocean, but never separate from it. And that's the truth of our being if we believe what Conversations with God has to say to us. There's no separation. Therefore, if God were to punish us with everlasting damnation and eternal misery, God would be punishing itself and causing itself to experience everlasting damnation and eternal misery, and that simply doesn't make sense. Because it doesn't make sense for God to do that, because that's what's true, that it doesn't make any sense, religions have no choice but to deny our oneness with God. You understand? You understand that if we embrace the idea that we and God are one, the entire theology of all the world's religions falls apart. It all falls apart. Because we can't comprehend, if it's true that we are all one, we can't comprehend a God who would hurt itself, damage itself, judge itself, punish itself, and cause itself to be miserable for the rest of all eternity because of what it itself did. You see? Of course, human beings do exactly that. You do understand that, don't you? I mean, in our human life, we do that to ourselves. We may have done something earlier in our life, a thing or two that we were really unhappy about, that we were unhappy with ourselves. I did something in my life that I'm not really proud of, not very happy with, and I punished myself about it for years. I don't mean for 2 or 3 or 5 or 8 or 10. I mean for 35 years that I hurt somebody early in my life. And I hurt them deeply, and I it was a very sad thing for me to do. But I was a young person. I didn't know what I know now. But 35 years later, that person finally said to me, Neil, let it go. I let it go 25 years ago. Let it go. It's okay. I forgave you 30 years ago. And that person gave me absolution, because I was doing in my daily life what I thought God was doing with us in the afterlife. That is, I was punishing myself forever for a mistake I made when I was 22 years old. You think I'm the only person on the planet who's done something like that? I promise you, it's a very common experience. And it is out of such human experiences that we have constructed a reality around God that says that God does the same thing. We don't have to worry about punishing ourselves. God will punish us for the rest of all eternity because we made a mistake somewhere in our lifetime. We chose the wrong church, or we chose the wrong religion, or we made the wrong choice about something else. And it was so horrible that God can't forgive us. There's no way in the world that God, who, by the way, we are told is all loving, all compassionate, all understanding, but if we do things that God does not like, or that God can't approve of, or that God simply can't forgive, we're in deep trouble. Really? I mean, really? Is this the God in whom we believe? Because if it is, if it's the God in whom you believe, no wonder you're afraid of dying. I'd be afraid of dying too, if I thought I was going to go to Judgment Day and sit at the foot of the throne of God and have Him judge everything I've ever said, thought, or done in my life. Because I've done a few pretty bad things by my own measurement. I've done some unforgivable things, things I can't forgive myself for. How can I expect God to forgive me? So let's rearrange our idea about death and about life and about the purpose of life. That God created physical life that we might know ourselves, that we might understand who we really are, that we might experience our divinity, and that we might express that divinity in, as, and through us. and that when we die, we go through a four-stage process. The first stage of death is when we come to see that we are not our body. Now, I've had a couple of out-of-body experiences in my life. I've had experiences in my life, actually three of them, where I was able to look down on my own body and see, oh my goodness, that's not me. I'm over here. That which is observing is over here, and my body is over there. I look like a wax figure or some kind of a doll lying there on the bed. That happened to me three times in my life when I've had out-of-body experiences. Many people have had experiences like that. Well, that's the first stage of death as well. It's a small death. And the first stage of death, we understand that we are not our body. We've come to an experience of it. It's not just an understanding. It's not just an awareness. It's an actual experience. I'm over here and my body's over there. I'm not that. Then we move to the second stage of death, where we realize that we're not our mind. And we realize that because we realize there's a part of us that's thinking about what we're thinking about. I mean, think about it. Have you ever had that experience? Have you ever watched your own thoughts? Have you ever thought about what you're thinking about? Have you ever said to yourself, don't think like that. Don't think those things. Well, who do you think is doing the talking? Who is that? If you're your mind, who's talking to your mind? What's that? And when we have the experience that we call death, we become very clear that the part of us that's talking to ourselves is not our mind. It's something larger than our mind, which can observe our own mind and comment on it and interact with it, actually. So the second stage of death is when we understand that we're not our mind. Now we see that we're not our body and we're not our mind. We go to the third stage of death when we realize we're not even our soul. We're not even the individuation of the only thing there is. We're not even a separate, identifiable entity, but rather we are one with the only spirit that there is. And so we relinquish in the third stage of death our thought that we are a soul that is somehow other than or somehow separate from. And any lasting thought of separation, any fleeting idea that we were other than the ocean goes away and disappears from our reality. Even as a wave, once it expresses, falls back into the ocean and no longer even experiences itself as a wave anymore, but it experiences itself as what it is, fully, completely, absolutely part of the ocean itself. And so we fall back into the ocean of life, if I could use the metaphor. In the fourth stage of death, we return to the only thing there is. We return to the oneness. We become, again, one with God. Now, I've experienced that in my life. I've experienced that in one of my out-of-body experiences, and I can tell you the bliss of experiencing that, not just knowing it intellectually, not just understanding it conceptually, but embracing it experientially, the bliss of that is indescribable. And that's the fourth stage of death. And once we experience that union with all that is, we have the opportunity, the blessed opportunity, to decide, do we want to stay in that experience, or do we want to remove ourselves once again? Not separate ourselves, but divide ourselves. You know, like corporations have divisions. They have a division in Cleveland, a division in Hamburg, a division in Paris, but they're still part of the same company, yes? They haven't formed different companies. Well, this is kind of like that. We decide, do we want to be a division of God and divide ourselves off once again so that we might individualize the experience? Because if we stay united in the whole, we find ourselves in that place of the absolute again, where there's nothing else but that, and we want to experience the contrasting elements that allow us to notice and to express in our experience who we really are. So we decide not to stay merged with the oneness, but we emerge from the oneness. This is called a spiritual emergency. That's a little trick of the English language. Don't know how that's going to translate into your language, but that's how we say it in English. It becomes an emergency. And in that moment, we remove ourselves again, become a division of the unity that we call God. And then we get to decide, do we want to stay in the realm of the spiritual or return to the realm of the physical? At that point in our life, we are asked, we are confronted with our own self-confronting question. Do you want to stay here in the realm of the spiritual, or do you want to go back into the realm of the physical? That is, I'm told that we can actually undie. We can reverse death. And we sometimes decide to do that. And on earth, what that looks like is a person who comes back from a heart attack or comes back from some death experience where they say, he's not dead, he's alive, he's alive. You know, the man on the beach who they thought drowned, but suddenly he spits up some blood and some water and he's alive. And people come back to life all the time that way. And that's because they've decided, you know what, I'm not quite finished yet. I had a little more I wanted to do in this particular lifetime. And we have the opportunity to do that, or to stay on the so-called other side for a bit and maybe come back later in the process we call reincarnation and come back in a different individuation as another identity. But whatever choice we make, it's a blessed, wonderful, and incredible choice because it's an expression of who we really are, another expression of divinity. So I'm here to share with you that no matter how you look at it, this is a wonderful, endless, eternal process. Death does not exist, but you exist eternally and forevermore. What a wonderful gift from a wonderful God.